Hi, welcome to our lunchtime date together with me, John Ballum. I am an organizational development consultant, I'm an educator, and I'm a coach with a passion for lifelong learning. With me today is my partner in crime, Gifty.
Hi everyone, I'm Gifty Parker, HR professional with a background in learning and development, performance management, as well as talent management.
So for the next 20 minutes, we invite you to sit back, find a glass of something nice, and enjoy an unusual conversation with us.
Good. Right, John. Yeah, good. How are you doing today? Lovely.
Very good.
Going into the fall season.
It surely is. It surely is. And the salmon are biting, I can tell you that. The salmon are coming up the Fraser now and all the other rivers. Makes me very happy.
I can bet. And I'm actually looking forward to going fishing with you again, going to our outdoor. Do that during the fall? Do you go outdoor?
Yeah, maybe we must do that. You catch a salmon, that's a really nice big fish.
All right, so for today's episode, John, let's tell our audience, what are we doing? How are we managing today's topic? Or what is today's topic?
We're looking at organizational culture today, and in three bullet points, we're going to look at what organizational culture is. We're going to look at and tell stories about our best and worst experiences of organizational culture, and then we're going to look at what HR and organizational development, and possibly coaching, can do to assist people to renew their organizational culture or get it to deliver the strategy that they want it to.
That sounds like a very lovely topic. Organizational culture is one of those topics that, you know, it's relevant to every organization. It's relevant to every individual. I read an article recently, and one of the questions that was posed is, what surprised the highest performing organization from the rest? And, you know, people came up with answers. Oh, clever strategy, superior product, superior service, superior... Caliber of candidate, and the list went on. And I don't think anyone even mentioned the culture, you know, that which is actually fundamental when it comes to an organization. So that was quite interesting experience to throw that question out. And when I do have seminars, I do the same thing. You know, what are those things that separate high-performing organization from the rest? And my students will list almost everything on the surface of the earth, but either culture is not mentioned or just mentioned once, right? It's really interesting because that's something that enables a competitive advantage, and it's very sad that its relation to success of high-performing organization is not really evident for everyone.
Right.
So what I want to do for our listeners, this will be a little unusual, is to play a little game with you to illustrate what culture is, what organizational culture is, okay? And ask you to participate with me, and then we can look at some of the dynamics of it, because there's parts of organizational culture or an understanding of it that is not common. And I'd like to give our listeners access to that, okay? So if we look at what organizational culture is, organizational culture is fundamentally the strategy when you start repeating it. Okay, so you take an organizational strategy, you start doing things, and as you start doing those things again and again, those things become organizational culture. But they become it in a particular way, and that's what I want to demonstrate to our listeners this morning, and the mechanisms of how the stuff we do in organization gets turned into this thing called organizational culture and what that is. Okay.
You know, to add to that, I was speaking to someone about culture, and we were looking at, you know, what is culture? What's the scope? What does it mean? And when you say the stuff we do within the organization, it just reminds me to those very simple things like our ceremonies, our rituals.
Yes.
What is important to us? What is our story?
Yes.
You know, our legend.
Yes.
Those are those stuff that we do, right?
Yes.
And some people don't see that as culture. You know, some people have a different definition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of what culture is. But when you think about it, that is your culture.
Yes. And what's really important is understanding how our psyches form culture. Okay. How do we turn something from from just an action, arbitrary action, and how does it become part of culture? And that's what I'm going to show. So I'm going to ask you to play a little game with me here. I made it really easy. So what I've done here is...
Oh, that's, thank you for making it easy.
Yeah, I made it easy. Right? So what I've done is there's some words here. Just read those words for me.
So absolutely. So I want to know...
Just start this.
So that's shop, right. Drop. I'm guessing that is slop.
That's right.
Plop. And stop.
Okay, right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to ask you a series of questions. These are the answers to the questions. And I want you to give me the answer to the question, right? And just say the word, okay? So when I buy something, I go to the?
Shop.
When I let something go?
Drop.
That's right. And I spill something. What do we call it?
Slop.
Yeah. And when something drops into a bucket of water, yeah, it goes?
Plop.
And when I come to a green robot, I?
You stop.
Do you? You stop at green robots. Oh, you stop at green traffic lights.
Okay. The green robot is the green light at the traffic.
Yeah.
And you at the green, you go.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Now I'm not trying to make a fool of you.
Are you sure?
I'm very sure. Because I don't know. I'll be fired from this podcast. Okay. So this is what we call the human mechanism of what we call habituation.
Mm.
So it's simply put, our brains cannot, if we have to consciously process everything, then we cannot operate. So as quick as we can, our psyches are geared to turn information into long-term memory and encode it in long-term memory. Okay. Now, there are certain things that help that happen, and many things that help it happen. One of the things is the rhyming reflex, which I made you. So when your brain started going and using the rhyming reflex and we're getting into the plop and the drop and the slop, then we hear green robot.
We don't take
that. Say, stop.
Stop. Because okay. We're going through the list.
Yeah. So this is how powerful the process of habituation is. And I just did it with you in a couple of seconds. Okay. I didn't do this with any big power structures here or any elaborate rituals around you. Okay. Now, this is what culture is. We had developed a strategic plan in an organization and we start doing it. Okay. And if we intensify why it is done, we make it important. We put authority figures around it, like mentors. We give it a sense of urgency. We make it exciting for people to participate in. Like, I try to make this a little fun for you. Then what happens is that part of our long-term memory is really turned on.
Mm-hmm.
And it wants to encode this as quickly as you can. So it can automatically do these things and move on to other things. Okay. So organizational culture is actually a part and parcel of how we habituate. And that's how culture is passed on to us as national cultures. So the important things our elders do over and over again, and we quickly, and the thing is, it's a program. Culture is mental, psychological, social program. And it's just part of how we built as human beings and has enabled us to do what we're able to do, achieve what we're able to achieve over all the millennia we've been here on this earth, okay? Because we can habituate quickly and then we can consciously learn.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely agree. And you know, I love this game because it kind of gives you an understanding of what that means. Because we can easily use the word culture is, you know, the prototype of our behavior, our unconscious, our conscious.
Yes, it is.
But when you play the game, looking at this game, it's just kind of, it relates a bit more.
Yeah.
You know, those things where you, it becomes an automatic system. The way you do things, it just becomes nature.
Nature. Right. Now, the thing about this nature is other interesting things happen with culture. So when we do something which we think is significant, okay, our brains are also scanning the environment around us to pick up on the cues. And the two cues they're looking for is it what we're doing right or is it wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're looking for feedback in the loop.
Yeah.
Now, what happens with all cultures, and I always say cultures are like dirty magnets, in that our brains sometimes do this process of misattribution. We something happens around us while we're performing actions in the culture, and we attribute that or we add it to our culture, thinking that was a cue from the environment. Meanwhile, it was just arbitrary. Okay, so this can result in like magical thinking. When I have good luck, at one time I see a butterfly. Now I begin associating every time the butterflies, I'm going to have good luck. It's all magical thinking. But organizational culture is like that too. Things can be happening around us in our environments, which we then associate. There's a direct correlation with what we're doing in the business, but it's got nothing to do with the business. Sometimes it's lucky. These things happen, and they happen to be fortuitous, and we're onto something new. But often, we collect, let's call it culture clutter, you know? I am too rude.
Plotter. I also like the word plotter of beliefs as well.
So everybody brings in their beliefs, right? So kind of culture has to go through a bit of a sifting process when you're a leader, right? You have to decide, okay, this is good for our culture.
And this is not good. So evaluating what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong.
Because cultures will just continue like on autopilot if we don't do that.
And you
can see how, you know, in some national cultures have died out or become toxic because they've just collected a series of beliefs and practices.
And they've not filtered through them, just cluttering them together.
And therefore they actually end up then paralyzing their strategic plan.
Right.
And we know why now, because of the game we just played, right?
Yeah.
That game illustrated it very, very quickly that culture is this unconscious programming, right? And because it's so unconscious for most people, even our own national cultures to a certain degree, we forget it's there. You know, there's this famous little quirk about what do fish think about all day? Well, it's not the water they're swimming in. The water is a given, right, in the tank. So culture is like the water in the fish tank. The life of the fish depends on the quality of that water. And we only kind of notice when it goes bad, when it's really working, you know, the fish think it's other things. They don't realize it's the quality of the water they're in.
And you see there, and we know how important the water is for the fish in the tank.
Same. Right.
Culture is very, very important. I always also say this as well. Culture is what you do, what people do within an organization and how they do it. That is another way to explain what culture is. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So maybe I want to start by just talking about a model for organizational culture, which I think gives people an understanding of this very nebulous thing, which seems to have all these different components. But the organizational culture has essentially, I call it a three-layer cake. So at the bottom of organizational culture, you have the values, beliefs, and assumptions of the organization. Now, these are not necessarily what's in the strategic plan. This is what people just do when nobody's looking. Not necessarily bad stuff either, okay? They just do it on autopilot. It's the way we do things here. And if you ask the average person why, most people would baffle sometimes to give you an answer. They'd say, well, I don't know. We just do it. This is where we are, right? But those values and beliefs and assumptions, they have kind of two parts to them. The one part is the stuff that's been deliberately encoded into culture by the founders. Right? So there's certain things that you do, you say, that are just part of who and what your culture is, you know. And my one, you know, example of that, which sticks in my mind, is when I went to pitch for business with Coca-Cola, you know, make sure that the people that stay with them become to believe in that brand. And then as part of that belief system, they have to learn the history of all the Coca-Cola bottles, all the different shapes those bottles were made. And I remember I was there pitching for business and he opened his bottom drawer and he pulled out all these bottles. In about four or five of these Coke bottles, and I had a half an hour lecture on all these Coke bottles, you know. Now, and the passion with which it was compelling. It wasn't bored, I can tell you. You know, I was thinking, I never would have believed. But you see, that's organizational culture, done right. Okay. So values, beliefs, and assumptions encoded, and then the other part, of course, is that what I call the clutter you pick up. You know, people join organizations with their own beliefs and assumptions, some which are good for the organization, some aren't. Or the organization erroneously just picks these up by a process of association. And that's the kind of junk. And then, you know, I always say organizational culture is like my garage at home. At the end of the year, in South Africa, I used to open my garage up, or a storeroom in Canada. And think, where did all this junk come from? Well, I put it there. I just didn't throw it away. That's the truth. Okay, the ugly truth, which my wife reminds me of. Okay, so I've got to get rid of that junk. Okay, so there are junk values and junk beliefs in organizational culture, which we've got to become wary of. Primarily, we don't want to let them into the organization. And if they're doing it in, we've got to weed them out as soon as we can. Okay, so that's the bottom layer of the cake. And that bottom layer determines everything, because upon that, we build our business systems. We have all our marketing department, HR department, all our IT department, all our business systems, and that also determines how we link those systems together, the communication process between those systems.
Absolutely, John. I actually like your example of you having your junk and your wife asking you to get rid of the junk. You know, when it comes to culture, some just to kind of make it clear for our listeners as well, some people simply refer to the observable behaviors of a culture.
Uh-huh.
The what and how, which is on the surface, what you see, right? But it doesn't stop there. We also have those shared mindsets, shared values, shared beliefs that it's not visible to you, but it's also a fundamental part of how an organization behaves.
That's right. It's all right.
So I remember this article I read. It mentioned the fact that think about a captain who is navigating a frigid water. You will not understand what are those things that gets him to navigate or move to one side of the river. You cannot understand that except you know very deeply what is underneath. You can only see the navigation, the movement, but you don't know what are those things that drive that. And it's really, really so important not just to neglect those parts of the culture that we don't see, right? Because they are equally important. Same thing with values. Why is John keeping all those, excuse the word, jugs? What, maybe that means something to him. That understanding goes a long way as well.
Yeah. So what I was saying to build on what you're saying there is you have these values, and these values are the architects of the organization in a real sense. Because, for example, you might have a very big marketing department with a massive budget, and people might say, well, geez, you know what? Why do these marketers have all this huge budget and we in HR have this tiny little budget? That's determined by a value, okay, in the organization, okay, that made this department well-resourced and this department maybe less resourced. Mm-hmm. So that determines the whole political climate organization and how all these departments interrelate with each other and communicate. And then above that is the bit that everybody knows and they see. It's the observable events, the stuff that happens in the organization, right? That's your icing on the cake. But, you know, it's pretty often, it's glossy, you know, most of the time it's the public face of the organization. It's what's on your website. Okay. All that stuff people see. Okay. But here's the thing, of course, is that stuff you see is linked to the departments underneath it as linked to those values. And so if you come along as some naive entrepreneurs sometimes do, or sometimes CEOs, say, oh, no, we want to change what we do here. You know, in other words, with the visible stuff. Then you've got to say, okay, you're going to change the visible stuff, but what systems are you going to change underneath that drive that visible stuff? What departmental changes are needed? Mm-hmm. What communication changes are needed? And then what value shifts are needed? And that's why, you know, this whole thing, Peter Drucker said, that's, you know, the organizational culture eats strategy for breakfast.
And I love that. I love that. And talking about change, you know, some people will say, oh, we're going to change the physical part where people see. But that can always be copied. But the deeper part, your competitors can copy that. That is the root, the main DNA of your organization. And that gives you that competitive edge, that competitive advantage. Because I can change the setting of my office. Any other organization can copy. So when we say culture is difficult to copy, we're referring to those ultimate aspects of your culture that is your DNA, that is unique to your organization. Yeah.
That's right. And it goes very, very deep, you know. If you think of your own culture you've come out of, I think of my own culture that I came out of, first Zimbabwe and then South Africa, as national cultures. Some of these things were drilled into us by mentors and elders, and they go right deep down into our personalities. And if people have been in organizations a long time, they are enculturated into those organizations, you know. And we've got to take a very careful and sometimes critical look at that and say, well, you know, is that what we want? Are those values what should be there? Okay. But if we don't do that, we end up with dirty cultures and cultures that are dysfunctional and diseased cultures, for want of a better word. You know? So maybe it's a good time to ask you to tell us a story, maybe about one of the best or one of the worst, or maybe both cultures you've ever been part of. What did it feel like working in a good culture? Let's start out with the good news first.
You know what? That's a very, very good question, really good question. And answering that, it's hard. You think of a simple question, it's really hard. I think, one, when it comes to a good culture and a bad culture, most of the examples I can think about actually things that are not on the surface. So I did have an experience. One of the first jobs I had when I came to Canada was as an HR generalist. And I remember I actually stayed within this role the shortest in my entire career. I stayed in the role a month. I think I stayed in the role.
Wow.
But I stayed another less than 2 weeks just to ensure that I did the handover. Mm. And that was solely because of their approach as an organization. So what was bad in this particular way of working was the way they regarded individual contribution. The way it was a culture where you couldn't contribute. They've set their own processes, and that was what everyone needed to follow, irrespective of what your own views were. And for me, that was a culture I felt was going to taunt my growth. And that was a culture that I felt didn't give me a voice. And that was something that was important to me. You know, that was something. So it was one where, oh, this is how we do things. I'll give you a very typical example. Interviewing process was one where one individual does the interviewing, one person, and I noticed people coming in and going out of the organization so quickly. And in order to investigate it, I needed to understand, how do you hire people? On what basis do you hire people? And what is your process? But the one person that does the interview refuses to share that insight with me. It's like a secret. And that's what HR generally. So when I couldn't get access, I went to the person who hired me. And now I'm just making this story very short. It's a
lot of information.
And I went to the person who hired me and said, okay, I need to know how this person hires. I need to go in. I need to observe. I need to ask questions. Why don't at the access? And his response was, yes, I know, Gifty, that you want to do that, but that can be done later. And this person is doing a good job hiring them. It's just the employees, you know, they just don't want to stay and they have. So he had a justification for it being a closed process and one person hiring and people not staying. I don't even know what interview questions they asked. So that was one part. And they wanted my attention to be based on. So it was a unionized environment. So my attention had to be based on the union issues and addressing the union issues. But I need to know the people coming in. I need to know how they're coming in. I need to know how they're taken care of. I cannot make or create an impact just by looking at policy.
Exactly.
And you know, letting them know when you've done something wrong, what the right policy is. I'd rather talk to you at the beginning. This is what the right thing is. I don't want to meet you once you've done something wrong. I want to prevent that stage. So it was a very interesting thing, but I politely had a conversation that it wasn't a good fit. But before I left, I did a presentation of what should be. Now, I don't know if we went and followed that what should be, because it was one where they weren't willing to change. And it was closed up. There was no growth. There was no opportunity to think, explore other opinion, other perspective, other ways of doing things. Because clearly, what they were doing was not working. I had people resigning weekly. I had issues. And yeah, so that was a culture where I knew I couldn't fit in. And we'll talk about cultural fit later during our conversation. So that was not a very good one.
Wow.
I will hold my good one by after you've shared your own example, and then I'll talk about a good coach.
All right. Okay. Because you mentioned that, I will tell a story about cultural fits, because early on in my career, you know, when I was less detached, I would, any culture I didn't fit with, I would probably label as bad. But then I began to realize there are different types of people and they really thrive. And some of these cultures, although they don't fit with me, they do a lot of good and they help a lot of people and it works, right? So one of my examples of cultural fit, it'd be embarrassing, but in South Africa, I took on the role of a project manager, or the director actually, of an arts and cultural center. Now, because I'm an arts and cultural person, I attend the arts and cultural, and my friends got hold of me and said, John, this is ideal for you. You know, you're an arts and cultural guy and you fit right in there. But managing the arts and culture and attending it as a two different bits, right? As a customer and a two different experiences. So this culture was a developmental arts center. And the actual center itself was structured very uniquely. They had, you know, they had an art studio, they had music practice rooms, they had a fine arts gallery, and they had a restaurant and a bar. And for example, the fine arts gallery was just above the bar. So on a Friday night, there would be some academic in there with the entourage of people opening an exhibition, and there's people downstairs in this open bar, it's like, get me out, you know? An academic shouting down, will you keep quiet? I'm trying to give a lecture. So there was this perpetual chaos. The restaurant was above the music practice rooms. There was a very upmarket restaurant. Then you'd have a heavy metal group practicing in there while people were eating in the restaurant. And, you know, some of the obscenities that heavy metal groups sing about, so there's some vocabulary they use is not too pleasant for these people that had dining, right? Plus the marijuana that floated up into the restaurant. So there was the actual physical structure, okay? So there was an enormous amount of chaos in this environment. And then, you know, the managing artist, I worked with a very talented musical director who managed the musical arts. And one day, one of his musicians, a famous South African musician, came. He wasn't there, so wanted to talk to me. And so she sat in front of me, and she had a lot of marijuana. And she, for 20 minutes, she said, kept on saying, I'm significant. Hey, I'm significant. Man, I'm significant. Whoa. I tell you, I wanted to take her and toss her into the ocean nearby. Of course, I couldn't do that. So I had to. But by the end of that interview, I was toast, you know. Now, I can't tell you. You know, I'd spent time as a school guidance counselor. I'd listened to deeply troubled adolescents and all that for hours on end. I was lots of patience, but I didn't have patience with this, right? Wrong fit. Whereas he could do this. He could, you know, brush up these egos and polish these people. And I realized, you know, there's a culture here. I mean, there was another dynamic too of getting up late at night. Some musicians would finish their sets. We had a big music hall, 12 o'clock at night. Leave the restaurant at 3 a.m. I had to entertain him. I had to be there. You know, now this is part of arts, the arts and culture and entertainment industry, right?
Yeah.
It was dissonant with me and my values and my family, but we had very successful. So I stepped out.
Absolutely.
You know, I stepped out.
And it's becoming an important topic lately when it comes to culture, especially when you are going into a new organization. Or when yes. organizations are merging, because with the pandemic, I see a lot of companies, a lot of collaboration, lots of mergers, and no candidates, you know, going into new roles or new departments. So that question of culture and that fitness becomes important. So I always ask people, you know, do you diagnose when you go into a new organization? When you merge, or you're collaborating with somebody new.
Yes, yes.
Is there anything going on? How do we know where to start to know if it's actually a fit? You know?
Yes.
And that becomes really important because it has to be a way where the two sides, the organization, the employee, there is that way of us to eliminate any misperception about the culture. Right. And I always ask people, even candidates, to ask questions, to even look at the organization, visit the organization, because that's the culture part. It's a fundamental aspect of where you work, who you work. So it's not surprising that you couldn't do that interview, John. Until next time, this is Gifty Parker and John Barlon.
Remember, during your busy week ahead, stay good, stay true, and stay beautiful.
Bye-bye.